You are listening to the Myth TV Cast. Welcome to another exciting episode of the Myth TV Cast. My name's Pat DeVille, and with me is my co-host Dan Fry on the phone.
How you doing, Pat?
I'm good, man. It's winter. It's snowing, and it's crappy.
It's kind of been affecting our schedule a little bit here.
Yeah, just a little bit, man. You haven't had a chance to come by my place and check out my new TV.
I know, and I'm dying to. I want to get over there. I want to see it.
It looks great. I'm loving it. I got a 40-inch Samsung LCD.
Yeah.
And it's really nice TV. I'm really enjoying having it.
That's awesome.
I'm watching it all the time, to be honest.
Yeah.
The other TV is a nice TV for what I paid for it. You know, it's a rear projection and everything.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
To be honest, I've been really, 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 really enjoying the LCD in the family room. It looks great. It looks great with my Myth setup. You know, with the default Myth Ubuntu theme. You know, there was absolutely zero issues with overscan or anything like that. It just looks perfect.
That's awesome.
Yeah, the only thing I had to do with my Zotac box hooking it up to, I just had to create an A sound configuration file, and it's pretty well documented how to do that. It's pretty easy. It takes about 2 minutes. And once I had that, you know, that little configuration file defined, my sound works perfectly over HDMI, no problems whatsoever.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, so what did all that entail? Just adding like a slave PCM entry in there for HDMI, and that pretty much
pretty
solved
much
all that?
Yeah, it was like five lines maybe in configuration file.
Yeah,
you know, and that's about it. And you know, my audio works, digital audio over HDMI. It's nice having everything go over HDMI, one cable for everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I have other things hooked up to it. I went to RCN and I swapped out my old cable box for an HD cable box, and that's also hooked up via HDMI. And I also have an HD DVD high definition, you know, DVD player, you know, the version that lost the format war.
Yeah.
It's still a nice upscaling DVD player. I have about a dozen or so titles that I got with it that came with it. That, those titles look absolutely great on it. It's a bloody shame
That's
I
awesome.
Don't have more movies for it. Those titles
are great. You know, you should hop around like eBay or something like that, see if anybody's offloading that stuff.
Yeah.
If there's anything you're interested in, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I have, I tell you what I have that looks really good on it. I've got the first Transformers movie. That looks phenomenal on it. I've got Blade Runner. That looks absolutely kick-ass on that. I also have 300. That looks awesome on there. And there's a few other movies that I have on there. Again, like Goodfellas and
we may have to set up a day to just kick back and watch some flicks, you know?
Yeah, bring some beers over, man.
Hell yeah.
We'll hit my stack of HD DVDs. And, you know, it's okay for upscaling. Eventually, I'm looking to get a Blu-ray player, especially one that does Netflix streaming in particular. Mm-hmm. You know, because I run all Linux here. You know, I really can't get Netflix streaming. The only way I can do it is I have on my laptop, I got VirtualBox running. I have a Windows XP virtual machine. On there, and that works doing that through a virtual machine.
Yeah.
You know, but that's not really doable for like a long-term thing, watching it on my TV all the time.
No, right.
So, you know, eventually, you know, the Roku, I hear good things about the Roku boxes, which are basically Linux boxes. But to be honest, you know, you can get a Blu-ray players are pretty cheap, and for like an extra $25-$30, you can get one that does Netflix streaming.
Yeah. A lot of TVs now that was a big thing at CES this year, was to push a lot of that online content onto the TV itself too. So I mean, you might see, you know, coming down the line, some of these
they're out at it actually already.
Cheaper.
There's an LG, couple LG models that do that, and there's a couple other ones too.
I think Vizio was one of them.
Yeah, there's a Vizio
that was
model.
Really promoting it. There was actually some ads during the Super Bowl that also talked about it as well, showing some of the online content.
Right.
And I think LG, I think your big ones, Samsung and Panasonic, were all kind of offering that. I don't, I haven't seen any real ads or anything like that other than the Vizio one.
Right.
But I think they're all going to start offering that.
Yeah, I was looking. You know, I wound up getting the Samsung LCD. I was also contemplating the other TV that I was down to was the Panasonic Plasma, one of the Plasma mm-hmm. models. And the Panasonics, they do some kind. They do have a form of streaming. They only do like mm-hmm. The Amazon streaming now. I've rented stuff from there once or twice, you know, not many.
Yeah.
You know, the Hulu, I have a Hulu subscription, so not Hulu, Netflix. I do watch Netflix DVDs pretty often, you know. I got rid of my movie channels on my cable subscription, and I just go with Netflix because, you know, I'd rather watch the movies I want to watch and not all the rest of the crap, you know, and pay for all that extra stuff.
Right.
So that's what I do. So, you know, if I had the capability to stream a couple movies, you know, once or twice a week, I would do it, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a nice to have kind of thing, you know? So if, when I'm in the market for a DVD player, a Blu-ray,
right.
I'm going to get one that does the streaming and just be done with it. It would be nice if there was a Netflix streaming client for Linux, you know, but it's clear that Netflix doesn't care about the Linux market. It's kind of a shame because I think there's enough people running Linux.
I sure as hell hope that something would come down the line. I mean, most of the stuff that runs Linux out there nowadays has that capability. Like you can put Linux on a PS3 and you could run Netflix on a PS3. I mean, there's nothing stating that the capability isn't there. And I really hope that they open their eyes, you know, to this at some point.
I think one of the issues is that the CEO of Netflix also sits on the board of Microsoft. And that's unfortunate, but that's the reality of it. You know, I actually sent Netflix an email. I said, how much would it cost for a third-party application developer to license Netflix to create a Linux-based client? And I don't expect to get a response from them.
Oh, let me know if and when they come back with anything. I'd be interested to hear that.
Yeah, I'd be curious to know whether it's, you know, in the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, or in the millions. I would think it would probably be in the hundreds of thousands, would be my guess.
And I read an article about the CEO of Netflix not too long ago, and you know he has a very strong vision in mind. He wants it to be, you know, everywhere streaming. You know, I mean, he wants to get out of the DVD business and get into streaming everything. So, I mean, whether it's on your TV, which most likely runs Linux in some way nowadays. I mean, there was that big lawsuit about that not too long ago with Blockbuster. I mean, with Best Buy and a bunch of other companies. You know, he really wants to have that everywhere. You know, so hopefully, maybe this relationship with Microsoft sours, that they'll be able to do something about that.
You know what the big issue is,
NVIDIA, provide a binary that you can install that enables the playback. You know, and just do something. I mean, he has like that. I want to say almost like a prolific, you know, vision about it. You know, really really wants to put it out there.
I think the issue is that, you know, the Netflix streaming is using Silverlight technology from Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, the Netflix streaming, I think, is the only application of Silverlight that I have any interest in whatsoever. I don't think anybody else is using it whatsoever. I know Major League Baseball used it for a while, but they stopped and they went back to Flash. And I think the NBC for the last Summer Olympics, they were using it.
Yeah.
And I don't even know if they're doing it now, to be honest.
Yeah, I haven't heard anything. But that's what it was over the last two or so, I think it was, the last two Olympics.
Yeah, and to me, this is the only application that I would care about.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see. Hopefully, you know, they come around.
Maybe they'll do something that can take advantage of HTML5. And then it's, you know, then any browser that you can have, and even like the Myth browser now, which is what Gecko, or I'm sorry, is a WebKit-based. You know, and should be able to just go native with whatever client with whatever codec happens to be installed in there. So that would be something.
You can only hope. You know, speaking of browsers, I've mentioned that during the tech shows. I'm actually getting away from Firefox. I've been using Google Chrome and Google Chromium quite a bit.
Yeah, me too. I got it on my on my desktop here on a Windows VM that I have. I have it on my laptop at work. I've got it on my Linux laptop at work. I mean, I've got it everywhere now, and I am really digging it. The speed for me, for a web developer, you know, it has a very, very good console for, you know, very Firebug like. That it allows you to really get in and diagnose what's going on with different web pages and whatnot. It's called the Chrome Inspector, I believe. I have really switched over. The plugins are great. The integration with the Gmail and the Google Voice. I can highlight any phone number and automatically have it call one of my whatever line I have attached, you know, to my Google Voice account. It's awesome. Now, with, you know, there's a Buzz client out there for it already, which only, at least at this point, only shows you what, you know, what new Buzz happens to be coming in. No posting to it yet or anything like that. But you name it. I mean, the count of extensions is growing, you know, daily.
Yeah, it's really impressive that they're ramping up this stuff. Mm-hmm. It's really nice. And you know, I've
set up the bookmark syncing as well, and you can actually go in then right into your Google Docs and look at all that. It just puts it right in your Google Documents.
I know, it's really sweet what they're doing there. It's pretty impressive, and it's the future, and it's going down the direction. I know people have privacy concerns and whatnot using Google applications and cloud computing in general, but it's really going in that direction, and it's interesting to see that somebody like Google, have a, you know, big company with a lot of money, what they're doing. You know, unlike some other companies, you know, these guys seem to still be innovating in different areas. You know, yeah, they go out and they still go out and buy companies like other big companies do, you know, more mature companies. You know, a lot of times they'll stop innovating stuff. They'll just go out and buy companies that are coming out with new things. It's good to see at least, you know, that they're still innovating somewhat in different areas. But anyway, enough with the Google love. Let's get into the discussion.
I've been following your tweets there and your idents there on how everybody's drinking from the Android fountain and whatnot.
Oh yeah, I love Android. Android's great. I have a G1 that I've hacked the crap out of, and it's a nice phone.
Yeah,
and a lot of people get Android phones. You know, some of these newer Android phones are really nice. You know.
Right there with you. It's just AT&T needs to finally open it up and actually put something out there.
There's actually two.
They've been talking about it. I had a meeting with Google not too long ago, and the contact there said that it's coming. And you know, yeah, okay, I'm waiting. I'm ready to go. And the wallet's open. You know,
it is coming. They're gonna have like at least two or three Android phones on AT&T.
Yeah, they made the announcement at CES. But they said by mid 2010 here. So I'm hoping by May we should start seeing something.
The ones that I heard that they're gonna get the Dell phone. They're also gonna get Motorola's is got this one called the Flip. They're gonna get that.
With the Moto Blur interface, which is just an interface on top of it.
Yeah, and there's another one. I forget who else they're getting one from. I think one of the HTC phones they might be getting.
Yeah, I think there was actually two HTC ones that I thought I saw.
HTC is nice. I like
it. It's
going
to be similar to the Droid, but it's probably just going to be renamed something else.
Yeah, and the Nexus.
I'm looking forward to it. I can't wait.
Yeah, and supposedly the Nexus is going to have a special version of AT&T too, supposedly. Mm-hmm. So that's good. You know, it's good stuff. But on to our show. We got some listener emails from everybody since the last episode. Let me see. We got one from Todd. Todd is using Fedora. He says he's been trying to use Fedora 12 as a front end, but he wasn't getting any sound. He did a bit of a little researching around, and he found that he needed to add a variable, export experimentally allow pulse audio 1. He says it's a bit of a hack, but it's the best solution I've found so far. So it sounds like he had an issue with pulse audio. What a surprise.
Yeah.
So, Todd, I'm glad you got a fix. So if people are running Fedora 12, they need to dick around a little bit with pulse audio to get the audio working. Let me see what else. We got an email from Don. Don says, "Gents, I'm looking to move away from Media Center or MidTV. I'm having trouble getting your podcast. It appears it's in a format the iTunes doesn't understand. Do you have an alternate feed so I can start learning what you have to say or any other suggestions? Thanks for your time." Well, Don, I have to be honest. I don't know if you know, but I'm not the biggest iPhone, iTunes, Apple lover. So If there's going to be,
I'm right there with you.
If there's going to be an iTunes feed, I'm not going to do it. I'm sorry, but that's the reality. You're more than welcome to, you know, create a feed yourself. You can take our feed and then create an iTunes feed. I don't have a problem with you or somebody else doing that if they want to do that. That's fine. As far as re-encoding our audio into MP3 or AAC, I'm not going to do that. But if someone else wants to do that, I don't have a problem with that. Our stuff is Creative Commons, I do believe, right? I think we agreed upon that, Creative Commons.
Yep.
Yeah, so, you know, anybody's free to take our audio and use it just as long as they attribute it to us. I'm fine with that. What else? I know for a fact that you can run Bash Potter on a MacBook or an Apple machine. I know, you know, that it works. Link has Apple stuff, and he's tested it. So if you want to get our feed besides iTunes, I recommend you using Bash Potter, Don, and using that on your Windows machine. It's not difficult to do, and that'll pull down the feeds pretty easily. Let's see, what else? We also got another question from Rick. Rick had a question. He says, greetings, I've been running NotMyth 5.5 for a while, and I've enjoyed it very much. I'm having some problems with MythWeb. Occasionally, when I try to download a recorded program across my network, it fails. Other shows will download just fine. The MythBox has been assigned an IP address, okay, and the Etsy file, I left it as DHCP. Then the MythBox will lose the connection to the database after 2 or 3 days. He gives us his specs, and then he says, installed approximately 8 months ago, so I do not remember the root password. Any ideas? Well, Rick, let me see. NotMyth 5.5 is the older version that was based on Debian, if I'm not mistaken. The newer version is based on Arch, you know, which he calls the Linhouse now. I think the real issue here is, Rick, you need to get a control of your machine. You need to get your root password. There are some pretty straightforward ways of retrieving that. If you do a search in Google for retrieving your root password in Debian, that should be able to find a how-to on how to do that. I highly recommend that you do that. And I would recommend that you make your MythBox with a static IP, configure with a static IP address. All my machines on my home network are statically IP. I use static IP. Just for the simple fact.
Mine too.
Just for the simple fact, I don't want my numbers changing around. And I always want to go to that IP address if I want to go to that box. If I want SSH into it and whatnot. So that's what I recommend you do, Rick. Recover your root password. Change over to static IP and see if that helps you. If that doesn't help you, then you may have some other issues, and I recommend you going to the Linhouse NotMyth forums, because those guys are experts, you know, with their stuff. I ran Linhouse for a while when it was in beta, and it's really nice, but I know it's very different from the old NotMyth.
I would probably say too that if you can shut off like DHCP and shut off any of that extra network stuff that could be going on like on the router and whatnot, and all the extra kind of chatty calls that happen every on a schedule. I mean, you can specify the schedule too. You know, I mean, it may be running into issues. I was running into issues with like if it was like, you know, updating an ARP table or something like that. You know, I would notice just a lag, and I've you know, switched off all like DHCP and stuff like that on my new wireless end router, and I don't notice anything anymore. So I mean, it might help just to kind of look and see what else is on there. If you can make stuff static, shut off some of those, you know, services and see what that does.
Yep. So definitely control your box, man. Yeah, I wouldn't accept not having my root password to any of my machines. That's not a good thing. So definitely recover your root password, or you know, there's a way of resetting it and using a different one.
Yeah,
that's first and foremost. So so what have we got to talk about as far as content this episode, Dan? You got any topics you want to talk about?
Yeah, so I wanted to kind of go over some tips here this week. Yeah, I've been messing around the last couple of weeks here since we haven't had a show. I was just kind of playing around with a couple things, and I wanted to bring some stuff up that I thought some people might find useful. First, the big thing that I've run into lately is, okay, now I got 3 boxes that sit on this network, and I plan to add a fourth one. Doing certain maintenance tasks on the thing. You know, you gotta log into one, log into another one, log into another one. You know, you go, and even if you're just talking, you know, app get update, app get upgrade, you know, that type of stuff. I wanted to find a way, and I remembered an article in Linux Journal not too long ago that was kind of talking about managing multiple boxes at one time, doing different things, or you issue the same command over. So I started looking back. And I found the article that I was looking at was Kyle Rankin, I think his name is. He does one of the hack articles in Linux Journal.
Right.
And he had this program on called Cluster SSH, and honestly, this is perfect. It's very easy. It's in the Ubuntu repos. I imagine it's in the Fedora, you know, ones, or even, you know, I guess what Lynn has his Arch now, we said. So I imagine it's out there. If not, the source is available, of course. What it does is you issue one command, and it spawns however many windows. So I could actually say, once you download and install it, you type in, instead of SSH, you type in CSSH for cluster SSH. And then you can just add any number of IP addresses or names if you have DNS on your network. You can add that all right.
So you have to have a client on each machine then, right?
No, you don't. This is just on my desktop here.
Oh, so the one machine can control everything, and it's just...
It just spawns, you know, as many SSH, you know, sessions as you put in the list. You know, so you could have, you know, two, you could have one, you could have 30 of them if you wanted to. What it actually does is that once you issue that command, it just tiles them across your screen. So you have, you know, one, two, three, four, you know, they'll scroll out and then just start dropping down, and you get like a grid starting of all these little SSH sessions. So I did this the first time, and I said, okay, CSSH, and I typed in the IP addresses for my server, for my, you know, my secondary backend and front end in the basement here, and then the Ion front end that's upstairs. It brings all of them up, and everything's fine. I can click on a single window and issue a command just to one window, or there's like a little window that opens alongside of it. You just click back on that thing, give that thing focus, and anything that you type after that gets automatically sent out to every box that you have, you know, that you're logged into at that point.
That's pretty damn cool, man.
So, as I go and I SSH, you know, I run this command and I start saying app get update, you know, and it goes and gets all the new updates that are out there, and then upgrade, and then if I need to reboot, I can send a reboot command to all three boxes at one time. Pretty nice to be able to do that kind of stuff. I mean, I could be, you know, running like HTOP on all the boxes and see what they're doing and just see, you know, the graphical presentation that it offers on all three boxes at one time. It's really, really nice. What I did a little more checking into this, and what I found is you can actually set up groups so that all I have to do is I created a group called MythTV. And what you do is in your root directory, there's a .css HRC file, I believe is what it is. And in there, you can specify groups. And so I made a MythTV group. It's got the IP addresses for all three of my boxes in there. And I just say CSSH MythTV, and it opens it right up.
Nice.
You could have multiple groups set up as well. And on that same, you know, command line entry, you just say CSSH, any number of groups that you have listed in that configuration file, and it'll just open up all the windows for all the groups at one time. So it makes it nice as you start to move forward and doing multiple things or having multiple boxes on the network to be able to go in and manage that type of stuff a bit more easily. So it's just a little hack that's out there that I thought was pretty useful, and I thought I'd share that one with everybody else.
Yeah, that's tedious. If you have multiple machines and you got to do updates and whatnot, and it's nice to be able just to fire off one command and they all do it.
Exactly. Yep, it worked. It worked pretty nice too. Let's see some other things that I've been doing. I've been going and messing with some of the remote control buttons on my remote. My Harmony remote has some nice, you know, buttons that I can differentiate between like paging, you know, page up and page down versus just going a single click up and down. That wasn't really mapped. I have a Harmony 880, so I wanted to go in and update that. And we've kind of touched on this in the past, and I just kind of wanted to talk about what you would need to do to go in and update your, you know, your key mappings for your remote control. Now, aside from having a Harmony, of course, you'd have to go into that specific software, you know, set up the specific buttons you want to have issued at one time, you know, that type of stuff. You can remap some of the ones on the LCD display. That's fine. It really does pertain to any remote control that's out there. The first thing that you want to do is everybody has a .MIF TV directory in their root. Underneath there, you're going to find an LIRC. What is it? Let me bring up the exact
LIRCRC.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the remotes, there's two files.
Yeah,
there's,
that's the one that.
In your home folder, you have LIR.LIRCRC, and that's where it actually has the codes for the remote. And then I think in your Etsy Myth TV folder, there's LIRCD.config, which is the configuration for the LIRC daemon. And in that one has the definitions for your cable box that you're, or your satellite box that you're actually controlling.
Sure.
So those two files are what's key to run your remote via LIRC.
Right. Correct. So I went in and then modified this particular file to utilize these two buttons that are on my Harmony remote, which I just mapped to something that happened to exist on an MCE remote control. Like they usually have four buttons on them that are like colors that aren't being used by anything by default. So I just kind of mapped those buttons into what the Harmony remote is actually sending out when I press those buttons. And then I took inside of this file, I just copied two sections of it and pasted them back in there. You want to specify the remote that you're using. In my case, it's an MCE USB remote control. The program, which is going to be Myth TV, the button, which is the button that the LIRCD is referring to the button as, and then the config is what you want to actually do to it. So this could be, you know, an external command if you're using IR exec, or it could be just a key mapping that Myth TV is aware of. So I just put in, you know, the page up and the page down stuff inside of there. And that was what allowed me then to remap stuff. I also added a script in here to restart the Myth front end, because sometimes the thing dies, it crashes periodically, and I wanted a quick and easy way without having to SSH into the machine to kill, you know, GDM and restart it. John Babb, who we had tried to talk with a few weeks back when we were interviewing the Mythbuntu guy, he has a little script out there on his website called bablogic.net that talks about, you know, it's a small little script. It's only maybe about 10, you know, 5-10 lines, something like that. That it goes in and finds the PID for Myth TV, kills any Myth TV occurrences that are happening, and issues I think it's issuing a restart on GDM itself. I could be wrong about that. I'd have to go back.
So this is a nice script for like the wife if she's home by herself and she's playing with it. Like
exactly.
The thing that I notice it crashes sometimes is with the music player. That's the thing that I noticed the most. Yeah, the music player bombs out. So this is if you say like your wife's listening to some music and she's going through the menus and the front end crashes, she can hit a button on the remote and everything, just the front end restarts completely on its own.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah, so I added this to both, you know, the secondary back end and front end and the Ion front end that's upstairs. And I periodically get some issues because I haven't mapped to actually two buttons. John would say, you know, on his post was saying he didn't want to have somebody inadvertently, you know, kill it. So I figured it was a good idea just to map two buttons in there. And so you just got to kind of get them going together. Periodically, I see that maybe LIRC is kind of hosed up too, and that doesn't always work. So I'm thinking of going back and just, you know, putting it in, you know, in some, you know, out of the way, you know, button on the remote that you don't typically go after.
I should set that up
just so you have one button for a restart.
You should post that, and I'm going to try it on my remote upstairs in the front end that I have upstairs. I'll try mapping.
Okay. Yeah, I'll put a link out there for John's article on his website. They're actually, he did mention that they're actually trying to put this in the Myth Control Center, so you can map this right from the Myth Control Center in when 10.04 comes out. So this might be something to take a look at, you know, with the next release as well.
That's
they want
a very
they
good
want
idea.
To have a nice quick and easy almost kind of like an on-off type thing right inside of there that allows you to map that. So it should be pretty neat. I'm looking forward to see what they come up with that.
Yeah, something like this, you know, it's a little thing. It's like, you know, the little shutdown option from the front end that was just implemented in the last release of MintTV. Being able to exit and do a shutdown with one button, man, is huge. It's such a simple thing.
Oh, it's nice.
But it makes the user experience a lot better, you know. And MintTV is not perfect, definitely. You know. Sometimes it'll crash. Like I said, I've noticed it in the music player especially. You know, I've seen the front end crash on me. So a quick, easy restart, I think, is a very good idea.
Yeah.
And the other
for
thing
me,
is,
the crashing, it seems to be with live TV. I tend to get an issue with the live TV. I don't use it for live TV at all.
Zero. I never use it. Yeah, I'm not interested in using it for live TV. I know some people do, but
I'm trying to move to the point where we can do all of it right from Myth. I want to get rid of like the one, you know, box that I have here, maybe even two of the boxes that I have here. You know, I want to have everything run through Myth, and I want to get to that point. So I'm trying to try all this stuff out, make sure that the live TV stuff works as well as it does with the just recordings or the videos.
Yeah, I mean, I could see the advantage of doing that. You only need one cable box, and if you're able to stream your live programming to other TVs around the house, I could see the you know, people wanting to do that, you know. So I there is merit to that, I guess. To me, I don't care, you know, but I could see some people might want that. And also, I also have a Harmony remote. That page up, page down button functionality is very important. You know, if you're going to do like schedule recordings through the listings, you know, there's a lot of stuff there. And if you have, you know, a lot of channels like we do, paging up and paging down just makes it a lot more quicker. Also, if you're doing an alphabetical search in the listings, it's the same deal. You got up, down. If you got page up, page down, you scroll through 20 at a time. It just makes it a little bit easier.
Right.
Yeah. So those are the two functions I could definitely, that you want to, you know, map in to your remote. Definitely customize things that are good to do.
Yep. And it's easy enough too. I mean, it's just a text file. You know, you can go in, make a copy of the thing. You know, and they've actually for this for the MCE remote specifically, they have all three versions of it, or two or three versions of those devices right inside here. So MCE USB is actually the module that's loaded. Whatever module would happen to be loaded for the MCE USB remote control that you happen to have would be listed right inside here. So they've kind of put it into a one-stop shop for it all. Now I'm not sure what the other distributions are doing with that, but I imagine it's something similar. I know when I was running Not Myth a while back, that they had, you know, a nice little front end script that allowed you to just go through and select the remote control that you had. And there was just a ton of options there. You could select from whichever remote control that matched, or at least closely matched, what you were doing. So I assume that they were doing something very similar there as well. Now, the last thing that I was trying to do was I wanted to start setting up some of the online media out there, the integration with that. So Miro is one for, used to be called, what, Democracy? It's now called Miro.
Democracy Player.
Downloading and aggregating all your, you know, video casts out there. It does video and does audio. I think it'll even, you know, catalog all the audio that you have. I wasn't using it for any of that stuff. I don't need it for that. I just installed Miro on my master backend and installed Miro Bridge. Miro Bridge is actually installed by default in this last release of Myth TV with the 0.22 release. So it's actually, it's in one of the contrib directories. I believe it was user share doc myth tv-backend/import/contrib/import. I mean, there was a long string through there. So whichever distribution you happen to be running, look into wherever it has any of the imported stuff. It's in there. It's just a Perl script.
But before you do that, let's just back up a bit. So Miro Player is basically a video aggregator, like a video podcast aggregator, and it runs on any Linux desktop. So what Miro Bridge is, it's a plugin that somebody wrote where you can leverage what Miro does and use it on your Myth box. So if you say you subscribe to some video casts, correct me if I'm wrong here, it creates like a shareable folder, and you're able to view those programs through your MIT recordings, right?
And your it actually, I believe it, all it's doing is it's creating a symbolic link into your recordings directory, and ultimately it would be into your videos directory as well. So when you would, after the Miro Bridge script runs, I just have it running once a night. Some people I see do it like every hour. I don't need it to run that often. But after it runs, it creates an entry in your watch recordings menu. And so you could scroll down and see anything new that has happened, that happened overnight or whatever it is, every hour. You see anything new, just as if a new recording has just completed. And you could see it happening. It works really, really well. You can set up a couple things with it, you know, right off the bat. You can change the channel number. What it really is going to do behind the scenes in the database is create a channel that you would call. So say you would type in, you know, channel 999. That's the default for it on here. It almost makes it look like there is a new channel called 999 under that's named Miro. That's fine. You can set it to be whatever you want it to be. There's some config options for that. You can check the wiki on the Myth TV site for that. What this does is then after you watch, I think we've talked about what the capabilities of it are in the past. So after you watch something, you can have it all. It'll automatically move over to your videos directory. It's not actually moving a file around or anything like that. It's just creating the symbolic links back and forth into these different directories. So there's only ever one file that it's ever interacting with. Everything else is just symbolic links. And it maintains history about it too. So after you've watched something, it automatically flags it in Miro that it's been watched. And if Miro is set to delete it after a certain amount of time, it's going to automatically delete it out of Miro and out of Myth TV at the same exact time. If you delete something inside of Myth TV, or if you delete something inside of Miro itself, the opposite location is reflected. So if I delete it in Miro, the next time the script runs, it's going to delete it inside of Myth TV as well. So it makes it really, really nice to manage all those files. You're not dropping a connection somewhere and leaving orphan files out there.
Yeah. So that piece is controlled by Miro itself, right? You can set an expire time on it so you've had something
exactly,
sitting there
yeah.
for 2 months, it'll wipe it out. You don't have to worry about it. So that's nice to do. I know that this new plugin that's being written by Robert McNamara's Myth NetVision, I think that duplicates to certain
that's another
degree
one I'm going to try.
What Miro does, but what Myth NetVision looks like it's doing, it looks like it's got more features and functionality than what you could do at Miro Bridge, it seems like.
Yeah.
But it's still under development.
Yeah, there's a bunch of options. There's a bunch of options you can add to it. Like you can say never move anything over to the Myth video. It's kind of like a watch it and forget it type thing. I typically just delete the stuff after I'm done with it. I haven't run into anything yet that I want to actually keep around and rewatch it again. I don't have the time to do that. So for the most part, I typically delete stuff. I was excited to try this out. I mean, after we were at OLF, when I met Aaron Newcomb, for the first time, he has a show called The Source. I've been telling you before that I was watching you on it from, 2-3 years ago, whatever it was.
That's a cool show.
From your OLF interviews. Yeah. And they do a lot of really good stuff. And I've just been kind of going back and catching up on a lot of those episodes. And I was waiting to do that till I had this integration set up, and it's been it works great. I mean, between this machine down here with the secondary back, and it's streaming it off the master back, and likewise over the wireless network with the Ion front end, it streams. I mean, he puts together some really good quality, good quality content using all open source stuff. He mostly does his editing on Cinelera, and I don't know what type of hardware he's using to record the shows or whatever, but they do some pretty good stuff. I've been really enjoying those.
Yeah, he does a great job, Aaron. Nice guy too, and I highly recommend anybody checking out The Source. It's a great video podcast. It's all about Linux, open source, and it's good stuff.
But that's what I've been doing lately. I've been kind of going around. I also threw the Hulu desktop back on these today. I had it on there at one point, but since then I had kind of redone the whole, you know, the whole setup here out of the new box, and I wanted to be able to, you know, add that stuff back should there be something that I wanted to go in and check out. I went back and took a look at some of the forum entries too, and this is something I'm going to do at some point. Somebody did write a script to launch the Hulu player itself and like disable like the screensaver from going on, and I think there was a couple other things that he had added in there, something about with some performance. He's able to boost the performance on it somehow and, you know, run it with some elevated privileges and whatnot. And so that's something I'm going to try out at some point. I'm going to, when I get a chance to sit down and take a look at what the script's actually doing.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I'd like to see what that's all about. You know, Hulu, mm-hmm. You need Flash, and as we all know, Flash sucks.
Yeah.
So anything to make it run a little
better. Yeah, on the Ion box, I was actually messing with, you know, with the new beta 10.1. It's in beta 2 right now, and I was hoping that there was going to be a little bit more with the hardware acceleration on there, but a couple people pointed out to me that they haven't done anything with it at all, and it's been a while since I looked at it, so I wasn't familiar with what they had done previously, and going back and reading some of that stuff, I saw that it's not even attempted yet that they're going to use anything with Linux for the hardware acceleration.
You would hope at some point they do that, like VDP, if they do something like that, that'd be awesome.
Well, I think that's the issue, is that they don't have a common way to do it. Like on NVIDIA cards, there's VDPAU, but I think they're looking for some type of, just a common API that would take advantage of whatever brand card you happen to be using, you know, so that they can kind of abstract that a little bit. And I can understand that, but we in the Linux community really need to have maybe some type of like an interface in there, so that whether you're using VDPAU or what is it called, Crossfire, I believe, or something like that on the ATI side, and I'm not, Intel hasn't even really started with the hardware acceleration yet, but I believe that I should say haven't started. It's just coming about. They're just starting to get stuff out there about their embedded driver that's going to be kind of like a competitor to the Ion platform.
Yeah, I've been hearing some stuff about that, and it's definitely nowhere near as being complete and as full functional as what
right.
is done
right.
with the Ion platform. So, I mean, hey, more the merrier, man. If these guys get their shit together and they come out with something comparable, I'm all for it. You know, having choices and options is a good
definitely.
Thing.
That's all what Linux is about.
Well, I've been playing around with, I've checked out Boxy, and I've also checked out XBMC in the past. Are you familiar with those apps?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yep. For people who don't know, both Xbox Media Center and Boxy are media front-end applications that you could install on your PC or laptop or even on, a small form factor box like an Ion box. And it's basically a front-end media system. So that, you know, you install this thing and you point it to your network shares or your directories where your media is sitting on. It'll go out and it'll pull down all the meta information for all that information. And then it has a really nice interface so that you can, you know, access all your media, videos, photos, music and whatnot. And they both do a very nice job of it. I know Boxy is a fork of XBMC. And XBMC started as a media portal for people that had Xbox Media, Xboxes, the first generation one, I think it was. And eventually they ported it out to just generic x86. So, you know, you can install it pretty much on anything right now. And Boxy is a commercial company now, too. And they've had an x86 version for quite some time. I think just now they're starting to get into AMD 64 version. They have a beta version of it now finally. And the big thing about Boxy is that they're coming out with a dedicated box that they've partnered up with, I think, D-Link. And at CES mm-hmm. they introduced it. I don't know if it was at CES or actually I think they had their own event around the same time. And they introduced the Boxy box, and it's a small NVIDIA Ion based box for like $200. I think they're going to sell it for. That'll have Boxy preloaded on it, and basically you can just set it up around your house and have a front end machine. Now my thoughts on these types of software is they're very nice. The interfaces are really slick. Okay, they do a great job of going out and pulling down your meta information for any content that you might have on a network share or whatnot, or stuff that's stored locally on your machine. Okay, it's really slick interface. They've done a really nice job of it. They have some nice plugins. I know Boxy especially has some really nice plugins where, you know, they have like different video casts will have their own Boxy plugin. And it's almost like a mini app plugin type thing. I think it's written in Python. So you can pretty much go out and write, you know, your little mini Boxy apps for different types of things. And it's real nice. You know, they have a decent community around it. It's all open source. So that's pretty cool. Now, my view on this is that if you're just going to do a media, you know, just media that you already have, okay, you're not doing any TV recordings, either Boxy or XBMC are the recommended interfaces to have if you just have, like, standalone, you know, small embedded boxes around your house and you're not doing any recording. You only care about online content. They're the way to go. If you care about doing recordings of TV, I think Myth TV is the way to go. Now, when I had Boxy fired up, it detected my MythBox on my network, and I was able to access all my recordings through Boxy, which was kind of cool. Mind you, it does not do commercial auto detecting, so it doesn't give you the automatic commercial skipping like you do if you had a Myth TV front end and you were going through that. Yeah. So this is unlike the Popcorn Hour box. I had a Popcorn Hour box for a while. The Popcorn Hour box is an embedded box that they sell. It's in like the $200 price range or so. And it's a small form factor box. You basically plug it into your network. It goes out. You tell it where your media is sitting. It'll go out and you can watch pretty much and listen to any type of media in all different formats, all different codecs and whatnot. Now, these boxes are nice. You know, they're I guess, like a really quick and dirty, easy way for people to get like their media and be able to attach it to a television. You know, the thing is, you don't get the full Myth TV integration, okay? And when I had the Popcorn Hour, that was the thing that I missed the most, okay? When, you know, with my Zotac box up front end that I have now up in the family room, okay, I turn that thing on, okay? Mm-hmm. And the whole experience is completely seamless, okay? I see my recordings in the menu. I select a recording, it starts playing, I pause it, I fast forward it, I get my commercial skips on the stuff that's been flagged, okay? You can't tell that media is being pushed over my network, okay? It's that responsive, it's that quick, and it's that integrated. It works great, it's simple, okay? With Myth TV, you know, with the current release, they have the storage groups now. Okay, it used to be when you had different front ends, you would have to go into your configuration, you would have to either set up a Samba or an NFS mount SharePoint, and you would have to say, okay, you have to go into the Myth video and say, okay, this is where my videos are. Scan my directory and pull down all my information and do that now. With storage groups, you don't have to do that. You only do that once on your main box, you set up a front end, and everything is there already. Okay, when I set up my Myth TV front end, the only thing that I needed to know was the IP address of my main box and the password for my database on my Myth box. That's it. You know, I put that information in on the setup, and I get everything. Everything's there already. So, like I said, the bottom line to me is, I tell people, if you're interested in doing recording, go with Myth TV. Okay. You know, you get the full Myth experience. You know, if you're doing front ends and you want to have an integrated experience with your different Myth boxes and whatnot, stick with Myth. If you're just going to do, you're just interested in a media front end application, go with Boxy or XBMC if you don't care about recording. Now,
definitely, that's what I recommend to people as well.
Yeah, I mean, now if you look at like, you know, the older version of Myth prior to 0.22. The menus were kind of getting dated and whatnot. And I think at that point, you know, if you go back, say, 4 months ago, you looked at where 0.21 was and you looked at what Boxy or XBMC were doing with their menuing and whatnot. I think, you know, their interface was nicer. Okay. But with 0.22, I think Myth is on a level playing field with those apps as far as the interface. Have you played around with Boxy or XBMC at all?
I install it right now.
Have you tried either one of those, Dan?
I did, but for a while I only have the 64-bit machines here. So now I actually have a box that I can put it on. up on the Ion box. So I'm actually installing it right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice to have an Ubuntu package that you can install. You know, that package will go out and install all the different pieces that you need directly from Boxy. You know, it's a slick, yep, slick interface. It's a really nice application. In fact, I really like their audio player that they have in there. You know, and there's also an option in there where you could share out, mm-hmm, your, you know, like a social media center, media setup where you can, you know, if you're watching something, it'll go out and post to Twitter or Denik or whatever. You know, some people might want it, some people might not, you know. It's nice that they have it in there.
Right.
And the little Boxy box that they're going to start selling looks like a slick little device. That little box would probably be a great Myth front end setup.
Yeah, it definitely would.
Yeah. Speaking of Myth front ends, I noticed that we're starting to see the second generation of NVIDIA Ion boxes starting to trickle through, which is pretty nice. It seems like the low, mm-hmm, end now is the 330 processor, the Intel 330. So that's what, yep, what's in my box. I think you got the same processor too, right?
Yeah, but mine has 4 cores on it. I was kind of surprised. I didn't think it had it, but it has. It seems to have 4 cores on it. I'm bringing it up right now.
Yeah, I mean, you can get like I know the Acer Revo, which was the single core box. They have kits that are out there for like $169, $170, $180. So you can pretty much get a full-featured, mm-hmm, Myth front-end on an Ion-type box for like $180, which is pretty much on par of what,
yeah,
the Popcorn Hour or what the Boxy's going to do. So, I mean, you can have a fairly reasonably priced front-end that'll do VDPAU playback and whatnot. Now, the Boxy boxes, they're going with a complete Linux stack as far as I know, which is a good thing. I'm glad they're doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I would love to get my hands on one of these actual boxes and do a review of it. So if anybody from Boxy listens to this show, you know, please feel free to send, you know, one to myself and to Dan, and we'll do a nice thorough review of it as a Boxy, you know, you using it running Boxy, and we'll also try it with MIT-TV too.
Yeah, definitely send them along. Any hardware like that, I'm willing to try anything. So
of course not. And that's all I've got on my end. What else? I think that's all I have for this week. I'm glad we.
Yeah, that's all I have. Like I said, I wanted to hit some tips for people. You know, some smaller things that you know maybe just kind of more kind of like annoying, like, you know, having to run updates on all your boxes, you know, at one, you know, set different times and whatnot. So, like, that's the cluster SSH thing was a really good find, I thought, and I thought everybody else would like that.
Yeah, I've heard other people mentioning cluster SSH, and it sounds like it's a pretty damn cool program.
It's so simple too. Once you got it configured, it's literally a 2-word, you know, command, and you know, you have all of your machines, you know, SSH'd in, tiled up on the screen. Works really, really nice.
Yeah, it's cool. It's good stuff, man. So people, you know, if you want to get in on discussion, we have a forum on the linuxlink.net. If you go into the Tech Show forum, there is a sub forum for MIT-TVcast. You can go in there and join. If you have any questions, you can post in there. You can also send emails to myself and Dan, pat@themittvcast.com, and also dan@themittvcast.com. We're both on Twitter,
yep,
and Identica.
You can also find us on Twitter and Identica, and now Google Buzz. And we're both on Facebook as well.
Yep. So, you know, give us a shout out. Let us know. Sponsors, if you know, you have a company that sells, you know, home theater meter type stuff, you know, we'll be glad to take a look at you as a possible sponsor if it's something that I think is close to our target audience, people that are into media center type stuff and MIT-TV and
exactly.
Yeah, so if you have like a case or remote controls or IR blasters or anything like that, man, you know, Hopog, if you guys are interested, Silicon Dust, and you guys want to advertise with us, we can work something out.
Definitely.
Yeah, so, you know, a short show this week. I think I'm going to try to maybe line up either Cecil from Linhas. I haven't talked to him in a while. Maybe we can get him on. And possibly maybe the Mythora guys, you know, Jared Wilson, some of the other guys that are part of that project. So that'll be interesting to do.
Oh, definitely. That'd be great.
Yeah. And maybe we could do another listener call-in episode. That seemed to go over pretty well. People like that a lot. And I think it was a lot of fun doing it.
Yeah, people were saying that they liked that.
Yeah, so maybe we can do another one again. You know, I try to, you know, if we do a listener episode, I don't want it to go on too long. I don't want it to go more than an hour. So if we get a lot of people, maybe we could break it up into two separate episodes and space them out a little bit, you know, put a few weeks in between them. So that'll be that. So everybody,
you want to get into a mod 2 schedule like some other podcasts out there, right?
Yeah. You know, this isn't like, you know, we don't have the time to do this every week. I'd love to do it every week, but I think 2 weeks is a pretty good sweet spot of coming out with new episodes. So we try to stay in that schedule.
Yeah, I agree.
Sometimes it gets a little bit much. You know, we both have, you know, families and jobs and whatnot, and we do other things. And yeah. I think 2 weeks is pretty good.
And we've been getting blasted here lately with the snow, so.
Yeah, it's winter time. Come on. Yeah, otherwise you would have been here already and would have been enjoying seeing my new TV.
Yeah, we might not have gotten a show off had I been there, because we would have been just sitting there drooling over that TV, right?
Yeah, we might have to make that a separate day for you to come over and check that out. Bring some beers over and we'll just sit there watching stuff.
Yeah, definitely. or at least we give ourselves an hour beforehand or something like that.
Yeah, if we can look through clips and whatnot. It's probably a good idea. So I think we're going to wrap it up. Everybody, thanks for listening. We appreciate you taking the time to listen to us. And if you have any feedback or suggestions, you know, give us a holler and let us know what you like.
We'll talk to you next time.
Take care. Bye.